Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take, well, a mountain of information, could be dense research, legal statutes, complex policies, you name it, and we really try to distill it down into those essential nuggets of knowledge, the things you need to be truly well-informed.
That's the goal.
Today, we're tackling a topic that is both legally complex and, frankly, deeply impactful for every citizen. Racial profiling in law enforcement. For you, the learner, maybe trying to navigate this often misunderstood area, our mission for this deep dive is really to unpack the legal, the ethical, and the practical realities. You know, what racial profiling actually is, why it's prohibited, and how it intersects with everyday police interactions, especially those common traffic stops.
It's a truly critical subject, really. And for anyone looking to understand the fundamental nuances, you know, of law enforcement's responsibilities and citizens' rights. Well, this deep dive is going to provide some serious clarity, I think. We'll be drawing heavily from official police training materials, legal statutes too, to give you a foundational understanding, really breaking down these concepts so they're accessible, hopefully actionable for everyone.
Absolutely. We're going to start by defining these key terms, you know, getting the language straight, then explore the specific legal frameworks that actively prohibit profiling.
Right.
And then look at some real-world scenarios to illuminate exactly how these principles are meant to apply on the street.
Yeah, the practical side.
Because this isn't just about what's illegal on paper, is it? It's about what's right, what fosters safety, and ultimately, what creates that enduring trust between communities and those who serve them.
Trust is huge here.
Sure. What does this all mean for you, whether you're just curious or maybe you're preparing for a deeper conversation about law enforcement? Let's unpack this. So to start, let's establish a baseline, maybe a common understanding. What exactly is racial profiling in the context of law enforcement? It's a term we hear a lot, right, in the news, in discussions. But what does it legally mean when you strip it down to its core?
That's a crucial starting point.
Yeah.
Because precision here is really key. The core definition we're working with, this is outlined in legal statutes that govern law enforcement. It defines racial profiling as a law enforcement initiated action based on an individual's race, ethnicity, or national origin, rather than on the individual's behavior or on information identifying the individual as having engaged in criminal activity.
Okay.
That definition is incredibly precise. And it lays out the fundamental problem right there in black and white.
So if I'm hearing that correctly, it's not about what someone does,
right,
but purely about what they look like or where they're from. That's the key distinction, isn't it? It focuses on identity over action.
Precisely. Let's break that definition down even further because each part is pretty essential for a full understanding.
Okay.
First, you've got law enforcement initiated action. This means it has to be an action taken by a police officer or, you know, an official law enforcement agent. It's not about someone's personal bias, their internal thoughts.
Right. It's an official act.
It's about an official act carried out under the color of authority. Second, and this is the explicitly prohibited element, the action must be based on an individual's race, ethnicity, or national origin.
Okay.
These are identity characteristics that are explicitly protected against discriminatory action. Our sources, they list these specific categories: Alaska Native or American Indian, Asian or Pacific Islander, Black, Hispanic or Latino, and white.
So it's broad.
It covers a broad and inclusive spectrum of identities, making it really clear that any action based on these characteristics rather than actual behavior is problematic.
And the final part of that definition, rather than on the individual's behavior or on information identifying the individual as having engaged in criminal activity, that's what a legitimate stop should be based on.
Exactly.
It's the critical contrast that makes the profiling clear. You're saying a stop needs a solid, observable reason behind it.
That's absolutely right. A legitimate stop needs to stem from observable actions, right? A violation of law or credible, specific information that connects an individual to criminal activity.
Okay.
But it's worth pausing here, I think. Because for many people, the idea of profiling itself might bring up images of, you know, sophisticated detective work looking for patterns.
Yeah, like behavioral analysis or something.
Right. So where did this concept of profiles in law enforcement even originate? It sounds like it might have started with a very different intent, maybe something legitimate even.
That's a great question, because I think a lot of people do think of profiling as something inherently negative now, almost synonymous with racial bias.
Yeah.
But the origins might surprise you, actually.
You're hitting on a key historical point that's often misunderstood, and it's quite fascinating, really. The concept of profiles in law enforcement didn't originate with racial profiling at all.
No.
No. Instead, what were called drug courier profiles actually began with the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, back in the early 1970s.
Ah, okay. The DEA.
Yeah. And these were initially developed and used in very specific contexts, like at airports, train stations, bus stops, basically as a tool for interdicting drug couriers.
So what were they looking for then, if it wasn't about race or ethnicity? What was in these behavioral profiles?
Well, the original DEA courier profiles were strictly behavioral-based characteristics. They looked for things like unusual nervousness when talking to authorities,
okay,
or maybe purchasing tickets with large amounts of cash, traveling to or from a known drug source city, but only staying for a very short time.
Right, like a quick turnaround.
Exactly. Carrying very little or no baggage for a longer trip, excessive travel on maybe unusual routes, or maybe immediately using a payphone right after landing. Remember payphones?
Barely. But okay, those are all actions.
They were all observable behaviors or transactional patterns that, you know, put together might indicate someone was acting as a drug courier. The focus was entirely on what someone did.
So actions and patterns of behavior, definitely not identity markers. That seems like a really, really important distinction. It highlights how a tool designed, maybe effectively for one purpose,
yeah,
can then morph into something really problematic.
Exactly. And that's precisely where the problem began. As our sources indicate, this system, which was meticulously designed for behavior-based indicators, it unfortunately got, quote, adapted to car stops for drug couriers and sometimes applied inappropriately in racial profiling stops. This is where that crucial and frankly dangerous shift from focusing on behavior to focusing on appearance or identity began.
Right.
And it's where the term profiling started to take on its negative connotation as it became misused. It's a powerful example, really, of how a well-intentioned tool can be corrupted when its core principles are abandoned.
That makes so much sense, understanding that historical twist. But, okay, beyond the legal definition, beyond the technicality, why is racial profiling considered wrong from a broader perspective?
Mm-hmm.
Our sources lay out some really powerful, almost visceral arguments against it. It's not just a technical violation, is it? It feels like it goes much deeper.
Oh, absolutely. It goes far deeper. The sources make it abundantly clear, stating unequivocally, racial profiling is wrong and will not be tolerated.
Pretty direct.
Very. And the reasons for this strong stance are multifaceted, profoundly impactful, and they go way beyond just the legal technicality. First, and maybe most fundamentally, it sends the dehumanizing message to citizens that they are judged by the color of their skin.
Yeah.
Think about what that does to an individual's sense of self, their, you know, fundamental human right to be seen as an individual, not just a collection of perceived traits based on their group.
That's incredibly damaging.
It isn't just about a negative interaction. It's about systematically eroding the very sense of belonging and dignity that really underpins a healthy, just society.
That's a deeply personal harm. I can almost feel the weight of that. But it also sounds like it has systemic effects, too. Like, it affects the entire machinery of justice, not just the individual involved.
It absolutely does.
It is.
Secondly, and this is critical for the system itself, it harms the criminal justice system by eviscerating the trust necessary for law enforcement to effectively protect communities.
Right. That trust factor again.
Trust is paramount. Without it, communities are far less likely to cooperate with law enforcement, maybe provide vital information about crimes, or even report crimes in the first place.
Makes sense.
When people feel targeted or unjustly scrutinized, that invisible wall goes up, right? And it ultimately...
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all.
undermines public safety for everyone, regardless of their background. If a community doesn't trust the police, everyone suffers.
And this gets back to that core principle we just discussed. Police are supposed to be focused on actual wrongdoing, on violations of law.
Exactly.
Not on assumptions based on who someone is.
Precisely. Our sources emphasize that police cannot ascribe certain behavior traits to a person or a group merely based on their race or ethnic background. Any police action, any intervention, must be because the person in question has violated a law, not because he or she is of a particular race, ethnicity, or gender.
Okay.
It hammers home the point, in bold text even. Police can only intervene based on what people do, not on what they look like.
Yeah.
This is fundamental to a fair and just system that upholds the rule of law for all.
And I can see how that leads to a kind of circular logic or maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy if you're not careful. If you start with a bias, you might find what you're looking for, even if it's distorting reality.
It does. That's the next critical argument presented. It's self-fulfilling bad logic. If law enforcement operates under the flawed belief that certain minorities commit more crimes, they might disproportionately focus their attention and resources on individuals within those groups.
Right.
When they inevitably find criminals within those targeted groups, because let's face it, criminals exist in all groups, it creates a misleading perception that seemingly confirms their initial flawed assumption.
Which distorts the stats.
It distorts crime statistics, creates an unfair public perception, and crucially, it allows criminals from other backgrounds to go unnoticed, which actually makes communities less safe overall.
Which would naturally lead to more tension, more animosity. It seems like a vicious cycle.
Exactly. Inappropriate stops, the sources say,
generate
suspicion and antagonism towards officers and make future stops more volatile.
Mm.
A racially based stop today can unfortunately cast suspicion on a perfectly legitimate stop tomorrow, just eroding that relationship between the police and the community.
Right.
This also has a very practical and potentially dangerous consequence, as it can escalate routine interactions into heated or even confrontational encounters, making everyone involved less safe.
And finally, it sounds like beyond the ethical and trust issues, it's just a terrible, inefficient use of police resources. It actually makes law enforcement less effective at their job.
It absolutely is. By focusing on race, law enforcement not only harasses innocent citizens, but they also, quote, overlook criminals of all races and backgrounds.
Wow.
Ultimately, it is a waste of law enforcement resources, diverting precious attention, time, effort away from actual criminal behavior that could be happening among any group. So yeah, it's inefficient, it's counterproductive, and it's unjust all at once.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, I think, moving from theory to practice. Our sources give us very concrete examples of what a racially motivated traffic stop looks like. This helps clarify the concept beyond just the definition.
Yeah, makes it real.
Showing us the scenario in practice. This isn't just some abstract idea floating around.
Indeed, and these practical examples are crucial for understanding the real-world application and recognizing when a stop might fit that definition of racial profiling.
Okay, like what?
Well, one clear example is citing a speeding driver solely based on their race, ethnicity, or national origin, when most other drivers in the same stream of traffic are also speeding.
Ah, okay. So if everyone's going 80 on the highway,
right,
but only one person gets pulled over and ticketed because of their race, that's profiling. It's about the selective enforcement, that arbitrary choice of who to stop based purely on their identity.
Exactly. Another example given is stopping or detaining the driver of a vehicle solely based on the determination that a person of that race, ethnicity, or national origin is unlikely to own or possess that specific make or model of vehicle.
Wow. That's pure stereotyping.
It's pure stereotyping based on perceived social or economic status tied to race, which has absolutely no bearing on whether a law has been broken.
Yeah.
It's an assumption about someone's identity and their presumed class, not their actions.
And the third type of specific example involves location, right? Which seems like another common dangerous stereotype.
Yes, exactly. Stopping or detaining a person solely based on the determination that a person of that race, ethnicity, or national origin does not belong in a specific geographic area or a specific place.
Like driving while black in a certain neighborhood?
Precisely that kind of
thing.
Again, it's about making assumptions based on identity and location rather than observing any actual unlawful behavior. It's a form of gatekeeping based on prejudice.
These examples really paint a vivid and, frankly, pretty disturbing picture of how racial profiling manifests. It's not just a theoretical concept. It has very real, tangible steps. But the sources also provide a very specific, typical pretextual racial profiling stop flow.
Oh, yes.
It describes a sequence of events, almost like a script. Could you walk us through what that typically looks like? Because this shows how a seemingly minor issue can quickly escalate into something much more intrusive.
Absolutely. This sequence illustrates a concerning and unfortunately all too common pattern. First, the setup. The vehicle is stopped based on a minor or contrived traffic violation, which is used as a pretext for closer inspection of the vehicle, driver, and passengers.
Okay, the pretext.
Right. The traffic violation might be genuinely present, maybe a broken taillight, maybe minor speeding, but the true underlying motive, the reason the officer singled out that specific vehicle, is profiling. It's using a minor infraction as a cover, basically, for a deeper prohibited investigation.
So they're using a small, legitimate reason to get in the door, so to speak, but their actual goal is something else entirely, maybe a fishing expedition.
Precisely. Once the stop is initiated, the second step often is that the driver and passengers are questioned about things that do not relate to the traffic violation. This is where the probing begins, right? Where the officer starts asking intrusive questions completely unrelated to the brake light or the minor infraction that supposedly initiated the stop. Then, often without a clear safety reason directly tied to the initial traffic stop, the driver and passengers are ordered out of the vehicle.
Which is a big step up.
It's a significant escalation of the encounter, yeah.
And what happens once they're out of the vehicle? What's the next move in this typical flow?
Fourth, often the officers visually check all observable parts of the vehicle. This is sometimes done under the guise of an inspection, but it's really a close visual sweep, looking for anything suspicious that might justify further detention or a more intrusive search later on.
Okay.
Fifth, and this is critical, the officers proceed on the assumption that drug courier work is involved by detaining the driver and passengers by the roadside. Now remember, this assumption is based on the initial racial profiling, not on any newly observed objective behavior or information.
Right. It circles back to the initial bias. And then comes the pressure for a search, which sounds like it can lead to a very difficult situation for the driver.
That's right. The sixth and final step in this typical flow described is that the driver is asked to consent to a vehicle search. If the driver refuses, the officers use other procedures, like waiting on a canine unit, running criminal record checks, license plate checks, things like that, and intimidate the driver with the threat of detaining him, tainting a warrant, etc. This really highlights the coercive nature of such stops, where refusal is met with escalating pressure and prolonged detention, even when there's no probable cause for a search initially.
This paints a very clear picture of what's prohibited and the insidious pattern it often follows. So given these profound consequences, how does the legal system, how do our foundational documents actually build safeguards against this? What kind of legal bedrock exists to prevent these very scenarios from playing out?
Well, the prohibition against racial profiling isn't just, you know, a policy preference or a moral guideline.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeply rooted in our foundational legal documents and then cemented by specific legislation. It's built into the very fabric of our justice system, really designed to ensure fairness for everyone.
It's powerful to see these core documents explicitly named, showing how deeply ingrained the principle is. For example, our sources mention the Declaration of Independence. How does a document from 1776 connect to modern racial profiling laws? Seems like a stretch.
Well, while it's not a direct legal statute you can sue under for this, the Declaration of Independence implicitly grounds these protections through its core principle of equality, right? That all
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Men are created equal, endowed with unalienable rights.
Okay, the foundational principle.
Exactly. Then, if you look at the U.S. Constitution, its preamble outlines fundamental goals like establishing justice and securing the blessings of liberty, things that are inherently undermined by discriminatory practices like profiling. More directly, though, you have the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. This is directly relevant because arbitrary and discriminatory stops are, by their very nature, unreasonable. They violate this fundamental protection of personal liberty and privacy. It sets the standard that interactions must be reasonable and based on legitimate cause, not arbitrary whim or prejudice.
And there's a state-level equivalent as well, right? Underscoring this commitment.
Yes. The Texas Constitution, specifically Article 1, Bill of Rights, Section 9, offers state-level protection that mirrors the Fourth Amendment. And interestingly, the source materials also mention the Bible as a moral and ethical grounding for these principles.
Huh. Interesting inclusion.
Yeah. While certainly not a legal document in this context, its inclusion emphasizes the broader societal and ethical condemnation of such practices. It shows that the principles against profiling resonate across various moral and ethical frameworks beyond just secular law.
So it's not just a police department's internal rule. It's enshrined in fundamental legal and ethical principles from the very founding of the nation. What specific, actionable legislative requirements are placed on peace officers and law enforcement agencies themselves to prevent racial profiling? How is this actually enforced on the ground?
This is where the statutes come into play, providing clear, actionable mandates. At its core, the law makes it crystal clear. A peace officer may not engage in racial profiling, period.
Just flat out prohibited.
Flat out prohibited. That's not a suggestion. It's a direct, unambiguous prohibition. And to ensure that prohibition isn't just words on paper, the law mandates that every single law enforcement agency that employs officers who make motor vehicle stops has to adopt a detailed written policy on racial profiling.
Every agency.
Every agency making those stops. It's about turning principle into enforceable practice, a foundational document for how officers are expected to behave.
And what must that policy include? What are the non-negotiables for these agencies, the things they have to put into their official rules?
The policy must include several key components. It has to clearly define what acts constitute racial profiling, making sure officers know exactly what's prohibited.
Okay.
It must strictly prohibit officers from engaging in racial profiling. Crucially, it needs to implement a clear, accessible process for individuals to file a complaint if they believe an officer has engaged in racial profiling.
So, accountability.
Right. This isn't just about internal accountability. It's about giving citizens a voice and a pathway to address grievances.
So it's not enough to just say it's wrong. There needs to be a mechanism for accountability that the public can actually use. Makes sense.
Exactly. The policy also requires public education about the complaint and complaint process. This includes providing the agency's telephone number, mailing address, and email address on every ticket, citation, or warning issued by officers.
Oh, that's practical. Right on the ticket.
Right there. This ensures citizens know precisely how to report concerns or even commendations. And very importantly, if an internal investigation shows an officer has engaged in racial profiling, the agency's policy must require appropriate corrective action against that officer. There have to be consequences.
And beyond policy, there's a significant data collection requirement, which sounds like it would be a major tool for accountability and transparency. It's about seeing what's actually happening on the streets, right? Not just relying on anecdotes.
It absolutely is. The policy must require the collection of specific, detailed information relating to every motor vehicle stop where a ticket, citation, or warning is issued, or an arrest is made.
Every single one.
Every single one meeting those criteria. This isn't just bureaucratic red tape. It's the raw material for transparency, allowing agencies and the public to spot patterns and ensure compliance. This includes collecting info like the physical description of the person driving, gender, race, ethnicity.
How do they get the race, ethnicity part?
Either self-stated by the individual, or if that's not provided, the officer's best determination based on observation. The initial reason for the stop must also be reported.
And if a search occurred during the stop, there are even more specific details required there, too. It sounds like it's about documenting the entire interaction, soup to nuts.
Yes, the report must state whether a search was conducted and, crucially, whether the individual consented to that search.
Consent is key.
Very key. It also requires the specific reason for the search. Was it based on something in plain view, probable cause, reasonable suspicion? Or was the vehicle towed or an arrest made? And a description of any contraband or evidence found must be included.
Wow.
If an arrest was made, the report must specify the reason, penal code violation, traffic law, outstanding warrant, along with the specific offense charged. The location of the stop, whether a warning or a citation was issued, that's all required. And a very important recent addition, whether physical force resulting in bodily injury was used during the stop.
That's a big one.
It is. And the chief administrator, the head of the agency, is responsible for auditing these reports to make sure the data, especially race or ethnicity, is included accurately.
So it's not just don't do it. It's here's precisely how you define it. Here's how you meticulously track every relevant detail. Here's how you report it. And here's what happens if you don't. That's a truly comprehensive framework. Seems like a serious commitment to data-driven accountability.
It absolutely does. And this data isn't just collected and, you know, filed away somewhere. The compilation and analysis of this information are also mandated annually,
right,
by March 1st.
Annually, okay.
Agencies must compile and analyze the information from each report. They have to conduct a comparative analysis, evaluating and comparing stocks of individuals recognized as racial or ethnic minority groups versus non-minority groups.
Looking for disparities.
Exactly. They also have to examine the disposition of stops, including searches, categorized by race and ethnicity, and evaluate the success rates of searches, how often contraband or evidence is actually found when they do search, broken down by group. All racial profiling complaints filed with the agency must also be included in this annual report, giving a complete picture of public concerns.
And there are specific penalties if agencies or chief administrators don't comply with these reporting requirements. That shows how seriously the state takes this.
Yes, the penalties are significant. If a chief administrator intentionally fails to submit the required reports, the state commission can initiate disciplinary procedures against them personally.
Wow.
Furthermore, if a local agency's chief administrator intentionally fails to submit the data, the agency can be liable for a civil penalty of up to $5,000 per violation. For state agencies, their executive director has to remit $1,000 per violation.
So real money on the line.
It really underscores that these aren't just suggestions. They are legal mandates with real financial consequences for noncompliance.
It sounds like the system is designed to ensure that this critical data is collected and analyzed and that there are clear consequences for failing to do so. What about officer liability for providing this data? Are they protected for simply fulfilling these reporting duties? Seems like they could face backlash. Yeah.
Yes, very clearly. The law explicitly states that a peace officer is not liable for damages arising solely from collecting or reporting this required information.
Okay, that's important.
This protection is put in place to encourage accurate and thorough reporting without officers fearing personal litigation just for fulfilling their mandated data collection duties.
That's a crucial protection for officers who are diligently following the law. But beyond policy and detailed reporting, what about actively training officers on this complex issue? Is that also mandated to ensure they understand these principles?
Training is absolutely mandated. It's a cornerstone of this entire legal framework. For police chiefs and command staff, their initial and continuing education programs must include racial profiling training.
So leadership training too?
Yes. This training specifically focuses on best practices for monitoring officer compliance, effectively implementing the policies we just discussed, and accurately analyzing and reporting the collected data. It's about ensuring leadership understands and can properly enforce these principles, setting the tone from the top down.
And for all officers on the ground, the ones making the stops every day, not just leadership.
Yes, for all licensed officers, there's a mandated statewide comprehensive education and training program. This curriculum covers civil rights, racial sensitivity, cultural diversity, and specifically racial profiling.
So it's part of the core training.
It's not just a suggestion. It's a minimum curriculum requirement for all officers, and it's a requirement for obtaining intermediate proficiency certificates. It emphasizes its importance in professional development and basic competency.
And we also see the mention of technology being integrated to help with accountability, specifically body-worn cameras. How do those fit into this framework, particularly with traffic stops?
Yes. Body-worn cameras are a significant part of the accountability picture now, offering a more objective record of interactions.
Right.
Grants are available from the governor's office for police departments and sheriffs to help them buy these cameras, especially for officers who regularly stop motor vehicles or are primary responders. This acknowledges the financial investment needed for the tech.
Yeah, cameras aren't cheap.
Exactly. Local agencies might be required to match 25% of the grant money, but state agencies are exempt from that matching requirement.
And the sheer volume of data from those cameras also needs to be stored, right? Which could be a huge ongoing cost. Are there grants for that too, to ensure agencies can afford to keep the footage?
Absolutely. Mm. There are also grants available from the governor's office specifically to cover the significant cost of data storage for recordings created with body-worn cameras.
That's smart.
It ensures that the financial burden of managing massive volumes of video evidence doesn't prevent agencies from implementing this critical accountability tool and maintaining the transparent record the law intends.
This truly covers the legal landscape, from constitutional principles down to practical implementation and financial support for accountability tools. It's a very comprehensive approach. So, what does this all mean in terms of how an officer can actually legally interact with a driver? We've talked a lot about what's illegal. Now let's explore what's definitively legal and under what conditions. We've established what racial profiling is and why it's illegal. Now let's turn to understanding what constitutes a legal interaction between law enforcement and the public, especially in the context of vehicles. There's a spectrum of these interactions, isn't there? Each with different legal requirements for an officer. It's not a one-size-fits-all rule.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
There are distinct levels of police-citizen encounters, and understanding them is really crucial for comprehending both officer authority and citizen rights. The most basic level is a voluntary encounter.
Voluntary, okay.
This requires no suspicion from the officer whatsoever. Zero. It's simply when an officer approaches someone, maybe a pedestrian on the street or a person in a parked car, and the person is completely free to leave or choose not to engage with the officer.
So they can just walk away. Or drive off.
They can walk away, drive away, or simply decline to answer questions. Think of it like a friendly chat initiated by the officer. You're not obligated to participate or stick around.
So no obligation to stop or talk if it's truly voluntary. What's the next level up when an officer has a little more authority?
The next level is a temporary detention, often referred to as a Terry stop.
Ah, the Terry stop. Heard of that.
Yeah. This is a step up in terms of officer authority, because it involves a brief detention of an individual. You're not free to just leave immediately. For this to be legal, it requires reasonable suspicion.
Okay, so what exactly is reasonable suspicion? Is it just a gut feeling, a hunch, if I were an officer? Or is it something more concrete, something I could actually explain to a judge?
Not at all just a gut feeling. That's a common misconception, and it's a critical point for our learners. Reasonable suspicion means an officer can briefly detain someone or make a traffic stop if there's a belief that a person committed, is committing, or plans to commit a crime. But, and this is key, it must be based on specific articulable facts or circumstances.
Articulable facts.
Right. A gut feeling or a mere hunch does not qualify. The facts have to add up to eliminate a substantial portion of innocent travelers. It's about looking for things that are inconsistent with innocent conduct and consistent with criminal conduct. So it's not what an officer feels, it's what they can see, hear, or objectively articulate.
And this standard comes from a landmark Supreme Court case, right? One that shaped modern policing.
Yes, it stems directly from the key Supreme Court case Terry v. Ohio back in 1968. This landmark decision established that officers can stop and briefly frisk a person without full probable cause if they have reasonable suspicion that the person has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime, and they also have reasonable suspicion that the person is armed and dangerous.
Okay.
It's a lower standard than probable cause, but it's still rooted in objectively observable facts, not just intuition.
And then the highest standard for police interaction, the one required for an arrest, is probable cause. That sounds like it needs even more solid evidence.
That's right. Probable cause is a higher standard than reasonable suspicion, and it's required for an arrest or a full search or seizure. It means law enforcement must demonstrate facts or evidence that would lead a reasonable person, not just the officer, but any rational individual looking at the same facts, to believe that a crime has been committed, is being committed, or will be committed.
A reasonable person standard.
Exactly. It cannot be shown based on an officer's mere suspicions or guesses alone. It must be based on facts and hard evidence.
Can probable cause develop during an interaction that started with the lower standard, like maybe a traffic stop based on reasonable suspicion?
Absolutely. That happens frequently. Sufficient probable cause can develop after the police have initially detained someone based on reasonable suspicion.
For example?
Well, an officer might initiate a traffic stop for weaving, which creates reasonable suspicion of driving while intoxicated, DWI.
Okay.
If, during that stop, the officer then smells alcohol in the driver's breath, observes slurred speech, sees open containers, or other objective signs of impairment, that would elevate the situation. It establishes probable cause for a DWI arrest.
Got it.
Other common examples that establish probable cause for an arrest or search include, say, smelling illegal drugs coming from a vehicle, seeing evidence of a crime in plain view like a gun or stolen property, or maybe an admission of guilt from the individual.
Okay, that clarifies the basic levels of interaction. Voluntary, reasonable suspicion for detention, probable cause for arrest or search. Now, let's delve into the specific theories for a stop mentioned in our sources. These are the legal justifications. the concrete reasons officers can make vehicle stops, providing that reasonable suspicion or probable cause we just discussed.
Precisely. These are the legal justifications that an officer must be able to articulate if challenged. The most straightforward are traffic violations.
Makes sense.
This is when a driver commits an observable violation of a traffic law, speeding, broken taillight, running a stop sign, expired registration, you name it. These direct observable violations provide probable cause for a stop, making them clearly legal and enforceable.
And what if the officer makes a reasonable mistake about the law or the facts? Does that invalidate the stop if the officer genuinely thought there was a violation but was technically wrong?
That's a great question, and the courts have indeed addressed it. There was a 2016 case, State v. Varley, where the court looked at a situation where an officer had a reasonable mistaken belief that the defendant violated a statute by driving with only one functioning brake light.
Okay.
The court found that even that reasonable mistaken belief was still deemed sufficient to provide reasonable suspicion for the stop. So if the officer's mistake of law or fact is objectively reasonable, meaning another reasonable officer in the same situation could have made the same mistake, it can still legally justify the stop.
Interesting nuance.
Similarly, in a 1997 case, State v. Clucker, driving on a tireless metal wheel, was deemed a valid basis for a stop because it constituted operating a vehicle in an unsafe condition.
What about something like rapid acceleration or spinning tires? Is that always a valid stop, or does it depend on the context? Seems like that could be subjective.
It depends heavily on the circumstances and how it appears to a reasonable officer. In Fernandez v. State in 2010, an officer heard loud tire squealing and saw a pickup truck, fishtail, which was consistent with reckless driving. That was a valid basis for a stop.
Okay.
However, in State v. Guzman back in 2007, the spinning motion of just one tire when a truck started moving from a stop at a green light without any other indication of unlawful or reckless behavior was not considered sufficient for a stop.
So context matters.
It really comes down to whether the action rises to the level of an actual traffic offense or creates reasonable suspicion of...
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Criminal activity, not just a momentary slip or noise.
This brings us to a concept that's often misunderstood and frequently debated, the pretext stop. Our sources reference Wren v. United States from 1996. How do pretext stops fit into all of this, and why are they sometimes controversial?
Right. This is where it gets interesting and can be counterintuitive for many people. The Supreme Court's decision in Wren v. United States declared that any traffic offense committed by a driver, no matter how minor, is a legitimate legal basis for a stop.
Any offense? Wow.
Any observable offense. The key takeaway is this. If an officer observes an actual traffic violation or has probable cause to believe criminal activity has occurred or is occurring, the stop is legal. The officer's underlying unstated motive, for example, hoping to find drugs, having a hunch about something else entirely, or even suspecting a more serious crime, does not invalidate the stop legally.
So the motive doesn't matter legally.
As long as there's a genuine observable traffic violation, the stop is permissible in the eyes of the law, according to Wren.
So even if an officer has an unstated motive, an ulterior reason for wanting to stop a car, if they can point to a legitimate traffic violation, like a tiny crack in the windshield, or going 1 mile over the limit.
Technically, yes.
The stop is legally sound. That's a significant point that often surprises people, I think.
It is, and it's where the intersection of legal permissibility and public perception, especially around profiling, can become very complex and contentious.
Okay. What's another theory for a stop?
Another important one is community caretaking. This was established in cases like Caddy v. Dombrowski in 73 and refined later in Wright v. State in 99. This is a critical exception, allowing officers to stop and assist individuals who appear to be in distress, even without any suspicion of a crime having been committed.
So this is about officers acting as public servants, helping people, not necessarily investigating a crime. This sounds like a protective role.
Precisely. The purpose here is protecting public safety, assisting stranded or sick motorists, locating lost children, responding to hazardous material spills, or urgent 911 injury calls.
Makes sense.
The requirements are strict, though. The officer must objectively and reasonably believe assistance is immediately needed to protect human life or substantial property interests. And the police response must be within the scope of the perceived need.
Okay.
For vehicle stops, factors considered from that Wright v. State case include the nature and level of distress shown, the location and whether the person has access to independent help, and the extent to which the individual presented a danger to themselves or others, if not assisted. The example cited is an officer stopping a vehicle because they see a passenger vomiting profusely out of the car window. That's a clear indicator of immediate distress requiring intervention under community caretaking.
What about stops based on information from citizens, like 911 calls? Are those always reliable enough for an officer to act on immediately?
Citizen calls can indeed be a valid basis for a stop, but the reliability of the information and the caller is absolutely key. The courts look at how credible the tip is.
So not just any anonymous call?
Generally, no. For example, in Crispin v. State in 2017, a 911 call from an identifiable bartender who gave his name and number, reporting an intoxicated person who had just driven away, was deemed sufficiently reliable to corroborate what might otherwise be seen as just a conclusory statement.
Okay, the identification helped.
Exactly. Even behavior that isn't a specific criminal offense on its face, like maybe stopping next to cars and staring, as in Derrickfeller v. State in 2011, can justify an investigative stop if there's reasonable suspicion the person is about to engage in criminal activity. But it's about more than just a vague tip. It needs some level of specific corroborating detail or observations by the officer that align with the tip.
What about larger scale police actions like roadblocks or checkpoints? Are those always legal, or do they have specific rules they must follow? It seems like they stop people without individualized suspicion.
They do, and that's why they have very particular rules. The Supreme Court in Michigan State Police Sits in 1990 upheld checkpoints for specific primary purposes, like ensuring highway safety by deterring and arresting impaired motorists.
Okay, DWI checkpoints can be legal.
Under federal law, yes. However, in City of Indianapolis v. Edmond in 2000, the court ruled that checkpoints established primarily for the purpose of deterring general criminal activity, like drug interdiction, are unconstitutional.
Ah, so it has to be specific.
It comes down to the primary purpose. If it's for a specific, documented public safety goal, like DWI enforcement or license checks, it can be legal. If it's a broad crime-fighting effort, a fishing expedition, it's generally not.
So it's about the primary stated purpose of the checkpoint. If it's a general crime-fighting effort, it's out. That's an important distinction for listeners to understand.
Exactly. And it's important to note that Texas is actually more restrictive than federal law on this point. Texas law does not allow DWI checkpoints because they are seen as serving a general interest in crime control.
Really? No DWI checkpoints in Texas?
Correct. So in Texas, checkpoints are generally only allowed for driver's license and insurance checks, not broad DWI enforcement like you might see in some other states.
What if an officer comes across a vehicle that's already stopped, like someone pulled over on the side of the road or parked somewhere? Is that automatically considered a police stop, or can it be a voluntary interaction?
Not necessarily a stop. In Murray v. State from 2015, an officer approached a vehicle that was parked partially on the road near a closed business that had been previously burglarized.
Okay.
The court held this was a voluntary encounter, not a formal stop requiring reasonable suspicion. The officer's subjective intent, maybe they intended to prevent the person from leaving, is only relevant if that intent is actually communicated to the citizen, like by blocking their car or activating lights.
So if the officer just walks up?
Right. If the officer simply approaches to ask questions and a reasonable person would feel free to leave, it's considered voluntary. The key is whether a reasonable person would feel free to decline the interaction and go about their business.
And finally, what about out-of-jurisdiction arrests? Can officers act outside their typical city or county limits, for example, if they see something happening while off duty or in a neighboring town?
Generally, yes, under specific circumstances outlined in the Code of Criminal Procedure. Peace officers can make warrantless arrests outside their immediate jurisdiction for felonies. Certain specific penal code violations like disorderly conduct or intoxication offenses or breaches of the peace committed in their presence or view.
Okay.
Certain municipal officers may also arrest for traffic offenses anywhere in their county or counties.
Mm.
However, officers must notify the local law enforcement agency having jurisdiction where the arrest was made as soon as practicable.
So they hand it over.
Right. That local agency will then take custody of the person and any seized property. It's also important to remember that individual departmental policies, might also restrict an officer's authority when they are off duty or outside their primary jurisdiction.
This provides a clear roadmap of when an officer can legally stop a vehicle, covering a broad range of scenarios. But once a stop is initiated, what about what happens during the stop? How long can it last? What can officers ask? And what about things like drug dogs? Where are the boundaries there for both the officer and the citizen?
This raises an incredibly important question about the scope and duration of a traffic stop, which is directly tied to preventing unreasonable detentions. The Supreme Court in a 2015 case, Rodriguez v. United States, clarified this. They said a routine traffic stop is analogous to a Terry stop. It may last only as long as necessary to complete the mission of the stop and address any safety concerns.
Only as long as necessary for the mission.
Right. An officer may not prolong a routine traffic stop without new, independent, reasonable suspicion developing during the stop.
So if the reason for the stop is a broken taillight, once that's addressed, the citation issued, the warning given, the stop needs to end unless something new comes up. Something else that creates new, reasonable suspicion.
Exactly. The initial mission of the stop is limited to addressing the reason for the stop itself. This is particularly relevant when it comes to the use of dog sniffs.
Yes, the canine units.
In Illinois v. Cabales back in 2005, the court found that a drug dog can ordinarily be used for a sniff test during an otherwise lawful traffic stop.
Right.
But critically, the stop may not be unreasonably prolonged just to do so.
Okay.
Rodriguez v. United States further reinforced this, stating the sniff must be part of the non-delayed traffic stop. You can't just extend the stop indefinitely, waiting for a canine unit to arrive, if there's no other independent reason for the prolonged detention. It has to be efficient and not add extra time to the original mission.
What about officers asking questions that aren't directly related to the initial traffic violation? Can they start asking about other things once they've pulled someone over? Like, where are you going? Or do you have anything illegal?
Yes, within certain limits.
Yeah.
In Arizona v. Johnson in 2009, the court stated that officers' inquiries into matters unrelated to the traffic stop's initial reason do not necessarily make the stop unlawful, as long as they don't unreasonably delay the duration of the stop without further reasonable suspicion or probable cause developing.
So they can ask, but it can't take too long.
The key here is that officers must build their reasonable suspicion during the traffic stop routine itself if they want to extend it. They can ask investigative questions alongside the normal traffic stop procedures, checking license, registration, running checks, but without causing unnecessary delay. If they don't develop new reasonable suspicion during that brief, lawful period, the detention must end once the initial purpose is completed.
So it's about efficient police work, making the most of the legitimate stop duration to build a case, if warranted, based on what's observed during that interaction. What about officers ordering people out of the vehicle? Can they do that, or does that require a higher standard?
Yes, they can. The Supreme Court established this in Pennsylvania v. Mims in 1977 for drivers, and then extended it to passengers in Maryland v. Wilson in 1997. During a lawful traffic stop, officers can order both drivers and passengers out of the vehicle.
For any reason, or just safety.
It's generally considered justified for officer safety reasons. The court viewed it as a minimal intrusion on personal liberty, outweighed by legitimate officer safety concerns, such as preventing someone from reaching for a weapon or maybe obscuring evidence inside the car.
And if an officer suspects someone might be armed during a stop, can they frisk them? This often comes up in Terry stops discussions.
Yes, under specific conditions. As established in that Arizona v. Johnson case we mentioned, police may frisk a driver or passenger during a lawful traffic stop when they have reasonable suspicion that the person is armed and dangerous.
Armed and dangerous.
Right. This is a protective measure, a limited pat down of the outer clothing for weapons. It's not a search for evidence of a crime. The key is the reasonable suspicion of being armed and dangerous.
What about moving a suspect to a different location during a stop, like taking them back to the patrol car or somewhere else? Is that generally allowed, or does that change the nature of the detention?
Generally, no, not during a Terry stop or temporary detention. In Florida v. Royer back in 1983, the court ruled that police officers are not permitted to move a suspect to another location during a Terry stop without a legitimate law enforcement purpose, like ensuring the safety and security of officers or bystanders, or maybe moving them out of a dangerous traffic area.
Why is that?
Because moving someone could extend the detention beyond what is reasonable or necessary for the initial stop, potentially turning it into a de facto arrest without probable cause. Also, any consent to a warrantless search obtained while the suspect was illegally detained, like if they were moved improperly, would not be valid. The consent must be truly voluntary and given during a lawful detention.
This is incredibly important for understanding citizen rights and officer boundaries during these interactions. What about the failure to identify law? This is a common point of confusion for the public. When can an officer legally demand ID, and what are the consequences of not providing it or giving false information?
It absolutely is a common area of confusion, and our sources provide very specific details from the Texas Penal Code, specifically Section 38.02. Think of it this way. There are a few distinct scenarios where you must identify yourself to an officer in Texas.
Okay, what are they?
The clearest is if you are lawfully arrested. Second, if you are lawfully detained, such as during a valid traffic stop or a Terry stop based on reasonable suspicion. Third, if an officer has good cause to believe you are a witness to a criminal offense.
Witness counts too.
Okay. And fourth, specifically for a motor vehicle operator who is lawfully detained for a law violation if they fail to provide or display a driver's license and they intentionally refuse to give their name, driver's license number, residence address, or date of birth upon request.
So the key is lawfully arrested or lawfully detained. And for drivers, if they don't have their license with them, they have to provide that other identifying info. What's the distinction for non-traffic stops, though? Can an officer just walk up to anyone on the street and demand ID?
This is a critical distinction. For non-traffic stops, meaning situations where you're not in a vehicle and there isn't a specific traffic violation, if there isn't a chargeable offense, meaning the officer doesn't have probable cause to arrest you for a crime right then, a person cannot be required to identify themselves unless they fall into one of those other categories, lawfully arrested or reasonably believed to be a witness.
So if I'm just walking down the street?
Right. If an officer just approaches someone on the street and there's no arrest or traffic stop involved and no good cause to believe they are a witness, that person generally does not have to provide identification in Texas.
What happens if they refuse in that situation?
If someone refuses to identify themselves during an encounter for a non-traffic offense observed in an officer's presence, like, say, public intoxication, they would likely be arrested for the contact offense itself, the public intoxication. Not for failure to identify, unless they were already under lawful arrest for something else.
So simply remaining silent or refusing to identify yourself isn't always an offense unless those very specific conditions, arrest, detention, witness, or driver without license are met. That's a crucial nuance for the public to understand.
Very crucial.
What are the specific offenses under the failure to identify statute, and what are the penalties a person might face?
The Penal Code, 38.02, outlines them clearly. If a person intentionally refuses to give their name, residence address, or date of birth when lawfully arrested, that's a Class C misdemeanor.
Yeah.
That's the least severe, kind of like a traffic ticket penalty-wise.
Okay.
If a person intentionally gives false or fictitious information when lawfully arrested, lawfully detained, or reasonably believed to be a witness to a criminal offense, that's a more serious Class B misdemeanor. Giving fake info is taken more seriously.
Makes sense. And for that motor vehicle operator who doesn't provide their driver's license and then refuses to give other identifying information?
For that motor vehicle operator who is lawfully detained, fails to display their driver's license, and intentionally refuses to give their name, DL number, residence address, or date of birth, that's also a Class C misdemeanor.
Okay.
Interestingly, the law clarifies that giving a different actual current address than what's printed on your driver's license is not an offense if it's genuinely your current address. That allows for people who have recently moved.
And are there enhanced penalties for certain situations, like if someone is a fugitive from justice, meaning they have an outstanding warrant?
Yes. If it's shown at trial that the person was a fugitive from justice, meaning they had a valid arrest warrant out for them, at the time they committed the failure to ID offense, the penalties are enhanced.
How so?
For refusing to give info while lawfully arrested, the Class C offense, it becomes a Class B misdemeanor if they were a fugitive. For giving false information, the Class B offense, it becomes an even more serious Class A misdemeanor if they were a fugitive. And if a false name is given by a motor vehicle operator during that specific scenario where they didn't show their license, that's also bumped up to a Class B misdemeanor if they were a fugitive. These enhancements reflect the increased societal harm when someone is actively trying to evade justice.
That's a very detailed breakdown of when and how identifying yourself can become a legal requirement and what the consequences are. What about other non-compliance offenses someone might face if they don't cooperate with an officer beyond just identifying themselves?
There are indeed other common non-compliance offenses outlined in the Penal Code. First, resisting arrest, search, or transportation, 38.03. This is committed when someone intentionally prevents or obstructs a peace officer or someone acting at their direction like a jailer from making a lawful arrest, search, or transportation by using force against them.
So force is the key.
Using force against the officer or actor is the key element. This is a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay. What if someone just runs away instead of using force?
That would typically fall under evading arrest or detention, 38.04.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Person commits this offense if they intentionally flee from a person they know is a peace officer or federal special investigator attempting to lawfully arrest or detain them. This is also generally a Class A misdemeanor, but can be enhanced depending on circumstances like using a vehicle or prior convictions.
And the attempt has to be lawful.
Yes, the officer must be attempting a lawful arrest or detention. The critical element is knowing the person is an officer and knowing they are attempting a lawful seizure.
And what about interfering with an officer in other ways, like maybe verbally interrupting them constantly or getting in the way physically without actually using force against them?
That can be covered by interference with public duties, 38.15. This occurs when a person with criminal negligence interrupts, disrupts, impedes, or otherwise interferes with a peace officer performing a duty or exercising authority. The crucial qualifier here is other than by speech.
Other than by speech.
Right. So if you're just speaking to an officer, even critically or expressing dissatisfaction, that's generally protected under free speech principles.
True.
But physical interference or obstruction, beyond just words, could lead to this charge. This is a Class B misdemeanor.
So what does this all mean for someone encountering law enforcement, and how can we use these detailed legal distinctions to understand common, often confusing situations? Let's turn to some real-world scenarios directly from our sources that really put this knowledge to the test.
Good idea.
Now let's bring all this knowledge to life by examining some scenarios directly from our sources. These are designed to test our understanding, you know, of racial profiling versus legitimate police action and how all these nuanced rules and definitions play out in practice on the street.
These scenarios are excellent for illustrating the practical application of the laws and definitions we've just discussed. They truly help clarify the often blurry lines, showing what an officer can and cannot do, and importantly, why.
Okay, let's unpack this first one.
Officer Jones and Mr. Carl Smith. Officer Jones, a DWI task force officer, notices a red Chevy pickup with a non-working less rear brake light on Interstate 10. He initiates a stop, using the brake light as a pretext for a possible DWI inquiry. The sole occupant, Mr. Carl Smith, a black male in his 40s, becomes highly irate and suspicious, believing it's a racially based stop. He's been stopped multiple times before in other states. He's talkative, angry, but poses no safety threat. Officer Jones feels awkward.
Okay. First, based on everything we've discussed about legal stops, was the initial traffic stop legal?
Yes. Based on the principle established in Wynn v. United States, the initial traffic stop was absolutely legal. The key fact here is the non-working left rear brake light.
The objective violation.
Exactly. That constitutes a clear and observable traffic violation. Even though Officer Jones had an underlying pretext for this stop, a possible DWI inquiry, or maybe other suspicions, the existence of a legitimate, articulable traffic violation makes the initial stop legally permissible, regardless of his subjective motive or the ulterior goal. The law permits a stop based on any observed violation.
So the officer's initial reason for pulling him over was valid in the eyes of the law, even if he had other suspicions. But were there signs of racial profiling in the stop itself? Mr. Smith clearly perceived it as a racially based stop, and his anger shows that. His history matters to him.
Well, based solely on the information provided regarding the initiation of the stop itself was triggered by a traffic violation, the brake light, not solely Mr. Smith's race. Therefore, the initial reason for the stop was legitimate and doesn't, on its face, fit the legal definition of racial profiling we discussed, which requires the action to be based on race rather than behavior.
Okay.
However, Mr. Smith's perception is absolutely critical here. His past experiences, where he believes he's been racially profiled before, are valid from his perspective.
Right.
And this scenario highlights precisely why racial profiling laws and policies are so important.
Right.
It illustrates how even a technically legitimate stop with a clear traffic violation as its basis, can still be perceived as racial profiling due to historical context, systemic issues, and an individual's personal experiences. It's a fundamental challenge for law enforcement.
This is a complex and emotionally charged situation for an officer to navigate. What does this all mean for how an officer might communicate in this situation? Acknowledging the tension, Mr. Smith's valid feelings, even if the stop itself was legally sound? How does an officer de-escalate here?
Yeah, it's tough. This raises an incredibly important question about de-escalation and transparent communication. The sources strongly emphasize the immense harm racial profiling does to trust.
We talked about that.
Right. So in this scenario, the officer should really focus on de-escalation and absolute transparency. It would be essential to clearly and calmly state the specific, articulable reason for the stop up front. Sir, I stopped you because your left rear brake light is out, and stick to that reason.
Be direct.
Be direct. Be professional. The officer should avoid any suggestion that the stop is based on Mr. Smith's race or appearance. While the officer can't necessarily undo Mr. Smith's past, painful experiences, maintaining a professional, respectful demeanor, focusing only on the observed traffic violation, and addressing Mr. Smith's concerns calmly and without getting defensive. That would be vital for managing the interaction and potentially, over time, helping rebuild trust, even just a little. Officer Jones is feeling awkward. That shows the very real human challenge of these perceptions and the impact of systemic issues on individual interactions.
Let's move to our next scenario, which also involves a pretext stop and how evidence is discovered.
Old car, unkempt driver, wealthy area. A police officer sees an old, battered car driven at night by an unkempt driver in a wealthy section of town. The officer suspects the driver might be planning a crime. The officer notices the car's rear license plate light is not illuminated. The officer uses this minor traffic violation as an excuse to pull the car over and seize the illegal drugs on the passenger seat. The officer arrests the driver for possession of illegal drugs.
Okay. Was the arrest and seizure of the drugs legal in this situation? This sounds like another tricky one where the officer's initial suspicion might not be what ultimately justifies the action.
Yes, both the stop, the seizure of the drugs, and the subsequent arrest were legal in this scenario. Hmm. Let's break down why.
Okay.
First, the stop itself. The officer observed a minor traffic violation, the unilluminated license plate light.
Another objective violation.
Exactly. As we discussed with Wen, any traffic offense provides a legitimate, articulable legal basis for a stop. This makes it a legal pretext stop, regardless of the officer's initial suspicions about the driver's appearance or the car's presence in a wealthy neighborhood. The officer's subjective suspicion about the driver potentially planning a crime was legally irrelevant to the legality of the stop because there was a valid traffic infraction providing a lawful basis.
So the traffic violation was the crucial legal justification for the initial stop. What about the drugs themselves? How did the officer legally seize those?
Right. So once the vehicle was lawfully stopped, meaning the officer had a legal right to be standing there looking at trees, the officer then saw illegal drugs on the passenger seat. This immediately falls under the plain view exception to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement.
Plain view. Okay.
If evidence of a crime is openly visible in plain view during a legal observation, like during a lawful traffic stop, it can be seized without a warrant. The officer didn't have to search the car in a deeper sense. The drugs were right there, openly visible, so they could be immediately seized.
And finally, with the drugs in plain view, the arrest seems like a natural next step. But was it legally justified based on what we learned about probable cause?
Absolutely. With the illegal drugs sitting there in plain view, the officer then had clear probable cause to believe that a crime possession of illegal drugs had been committed. This probable cause legally justified the immediate arrest of the driver.
So it flowed legally.
Yes. So while the officer's initial suspicion based on appearance and location wasn't the legal basis for the stop, the observed traffic violation was. And that legitimate stop led directly to the lawful discovery of evidence in plain view, which in turn provided probable cause for a perfectly legal arrest. It illustrates how a lawful stop for one reason can lead to other lawful actions if new information arises during the encounter.
Next scenario. This one feels like it gets right to the heart of profiling and that crucial distinction between behavior and identity.
Older SUV, Middle Eastern men, feeling. An officer notices nearly all vehicles exceeding the speed limit on a highway. The officer's attention is immediately drawn to an older SUV traveling slower than other vehicles, but at the posted speed limit. The SUV contains four young bearded Middle Eastern men, each wearing a keffiyeh turban. The officer initiates a traffic stop based on a feeling that he should further investigate what the men are doing.
Okay. Would this situation be considered racial profiling? This seems like a textbook example of what we defined earlier, where appearance seems to override behavior.
Unequivocally, yes. This is a classic and very clear example of racial profiling as defined in our sources, and it directly violates the principles we've discussed. Let's look at why.
Okay.
First, there is a distinct lack of behavior-based suspicion. The vehicle was not speeding. In fact, it was traveling at the posted speed limit, maybe even slower than traffic. There was no observed traffic violation, no erratic driving, or any other behavior indicating criminal activity. The primary reason the officer's attention was drawn was not due to a violation of law, but to something else entirely.
And the basis for the stop was explicitly a feeling tied directly to the occupant's identity and appearance.
Exactly. The stop was initiated solely because of the officer's feeling, which was explicitly triggered by the occupant's identity characteristics. Their perceived race ethnicity, Middle Eastern, and their appearance, young, bearded, wearing keffiyehs. This directly violates the fundamental principle we hammered home earlier, that police action must be based on a person's behavior or information identifying criminal activity, not on their identity characteristics like race, ethnicity, or national origin. There is simply no articulable, reasonable suspicion of a crime based on any actions taken by the occupants here.
It perfectly fits the legal definition we started with, action based on identity, not behavior.
It does. This scenario perfectly fits the definition of racial profiling. Quote, a law enforcement initiated action based on an individual's race, ethnicity, or national origin, rather than on the individual's behavior or on information identifying the individual as having engaged in criminal activity. This kind of stop is exactly what erodes public trust, fosters antagonism, and is precisely what racial profiling laws are designed to prevent. It's a clear example of that self-fulfilling bad logic we discussed earlier, where bias drives action without any legitimate cause.
A very clear distinction there. Finally, let's look at this last scenario. This one involves a community reporting suspicious activity, a type of call that police often respond to, and it brings up stereotypes again.
Range Rover, black males, suspicious activity in neighborhood. A homeowner in an exclusive suburban neighborhood reports a late model maroon Range Rover with out-of-state registration as suspicious activity. The vehicle is occupied by two black males in their early 20s. The neighborhood has a cooperative crime prevention effort. An officer responds and quickly encounters the Range Rover.
Okay. Should the officer activate overhead lights to stop and identify the vehicle's occupants just to see what they are doing in the neighborhood? Explain why or why not, and how you would handle the call if you were that officer.
This scenario raises a really important question regarding what constitutes suspicious activity in the eyes of the law versus what might be a community's perception, especially given the description, exclusive neighborhood, specific description of the occupants and car. It really forces a look at whether a citizen's suspicion is legally actionable for the police.
So just because someone calls something suspicious doesn't automatically mean an officer has legal grounds for a stop and detention. It requires more than just the label.
Precisely. Based on the information provided in this scenario, the officer should not activate overhead lights to initiate a stop and detain the vehicle.
Why not?
Because there is no reasonable suspicion of criminal activity based on these facts alone. Let's break it down. First, there's no mention of any traffic violation, which, as we know, would be a clear basis for a stop.
Right.
Second, and crucially, there is no observed criminal behavior reported or seen by the officer. The vehicle is simply present in a neighborhood. The fact that it's a late model Range Rover with out-of-state registration and the occupants are two black males in their early 20s are identity characteristics or vehicle characteristics, not behaviors indicative of a crime.
So even with the homeowner's report and the neighborhood's crime prevention effort, the legal standard for a stop isn't met. It sounds like the suspicion reported is based on stereotypes, not actual observed facts of wrongdoing.
That's correct. While the homeowner reported suspicious activity, that suspicion, as presented in this scenario, appears to be based on racial and potentially class stereotypes. Young black men in a luxury car in an exclusive neighborhood, rather than actual observed criminal conduct. The officer cannot simply act on a feeling or a conclusory statement. They look suspicious. From a citizen without additional specific and articulable corroborating details of actual criminal behavior. The Supreme Court has been clear that a mere hunch or a vague, uncorroborated tip is not enough for reasonable suspicion to justify a detention, a stop. The report of suspicious activity must contain facts that suggest a crime is being committed, is about to be committed, or just occurred, and in this scenario, those concrete facts are absent.
So how should an officer handle this call if they can't make a formal coercive stop? What's the appropriate police action here, if any?
Well, the officer could, however, engage in a voluntary encounter.
Ah, back to voluntary.
Right. Rather than activating lights and initiating a detention, the officer could perhaps pull alongside or behind the vehicle without activating their emergency lights and simply approach the occupants to ask questions. Hey guys, how's it going? Just checking on things in the neighborhood.
And they'd be free to leave.
During a voluntary encounter, the occupants would be entirely free to leave or decline to answer any questions. This approach falls under that voluntary encounter level of police interaction, which, as we discussed, requires no suspicion whatsoever because it doesn't restrict anyone's freedom of movement.
And if something genuinely suspicious then develops during that voluntary interaction, that could change things. The officer could potentially build reasonable suspicion from that point.
Exactly. If, during this voluntary encounter, the officer observes behavior that does generate reasonable suspicion of a crime, for instance, seeing contraband in plain view, observing furtive movements indicating someone's trying to hide something, or hearing something that suggests criminal intent, then a lawful detention or stop could be initiated based on those new facts. This scenario powerfully reinforces the fundamental principle. Police can only intervene based on what people do, based on observable and articulable facts, not on what they look like or where they are seen. It's about being proactive and engaging when appropriate, but always within the bounds of the law and with respect for individual liberty.
Wow, that was a truly comprehensive deep dive into racial profiling and the complexities of police interactions. We've gone from the core definitions and the historical context of profiling, all the way to the profound ethical implications, the robust legal framework governing law enforcement, and even into those real-world applications through those compelling scenarios.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, understanding these distinctions isn't just about, you know, legal technicalities. It's absolutely paramount for fostering genuine trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve. It really is.
Seems foundational.
When stops are consistently based on legitimate, articulable facts and behaviors, rather than identity, the entire criminal justice system functions more effectively and, frankly, more fairly for everyone. It's about upholding the integrity of the law and ensuring justice is truly blind as it's supposed to be.
Absolutely. And for you, our learner, being well informed on this topic means you can better understand your rights, the specific responsibilities of law enforcement, and importantly, you can contribute to conversations about justice and community safety in a truly informed way. The clarity around reasonable suspicion versus a mere hunch, and the legality, maybe the controversy around pretext stops under specific conditions. Those are just a couple of the aha moments we hope you've had during this deep dive, offering maybe new ways to think about these vital interactions.
My final thought on this is this. While the law clearly outlines what is permissible, the ultimate health and safety of the profession, as the source material itself points out, really relies on officers not just following the letter of the law, but truly upholding its spirit.
The spirit of the law.
Yeah. This means making sure all investigative stops are made on real, reasonable suspicion, genuinely observed and articulated, and not simply on contrived reasons or, you know, those that are merely articulated appropriately just to sound legal after the fact. It's about a genuine commitment to justice and fairness, not just checking boxes or finding loopholes.
Powerful words to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging for knowledge.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.